Good evening and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conversation with Josh Parker and Alan Salzbank of River Park Gargoyle Hedged Value. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Snowball. Please go ahead, sir.
Great. Thank you, Denise, and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Mutual Fund Observers Chat with Josh Parker and Alan Salzman, managers, as Denise noted, of the River Park Gargoyle Hedged Value Fund. I'm pleased to note that we're also joined on the call by Morty Shaya, River Park's Chief Executive Officer and co-founder. We can begin with the obvious, that about 80% of all mutual funds could close their doors today and no one would miss them. If I had to describe them as group, I'd use words like large, unimaginative, undistinguished asset sponges. They thrive by never being bad enough to dump, and so year after year, their numbers swell. By one estimate, 30% of all mutual fund money is invested in closet index funds, nominally active funds whose strategy and portfolio are barely distinguished from the index. Sadly, those are the funds that win analyst coverage and draw a lot of investor attention. The same sad pattern afflicted the nominally innovative new active category of long-short funds. That category drew about $20 billion in inflows last year, despite a 0.95 correlation with the S&P 500, which is to say the average long-short fund had a correlation identical over the last 5 years to a long-only large-cap core fund, which is further to say their higher expenses and theoretical flexibility bought you precisely zero, but brought their advisors about $20 billion in assets and $300 million or so in revenue each year. Because of an experienced and distressing number of those funds are run by managers who still need training wheels. With documented, audited 15-year record as both a limited partnership and a mutual fund, Gargoyle stands apart from that crowd, for which I'm deeply grateful. Our plan tonight is to devote the first third of our time together to an introduction to the fund, the middle third to my conversation with Josh and Alan, and the final third to your questions. As we approach that final third, we will give you a reminder about how you can ask questions of the managers. But for now, I would like to take a second and welcome Morty Shaya to the call. Hi, Morty.
Hi, David. I appreciate the opportunity once again to be on a conference call with you and your followers. The River Park Gargoyle Hedge Value Fund is one of seven mutual funds that we offer through the River Park Funds family, and it represents the strategic alliance between River Park and Gargoyle Investment Advisor. I've been a longtime believer in the underlying strategy behind this fund. Back in the 1980s, I was involved in the early research on what we called buy-right strategies, using the sale of call options to generate income and to partially hedge portfolios. And we believed back then, and still believe today, that investors would benefit from giving away some of the excessive returns that they can get, sort of capping their returns in any single period for some increased stability and some amount of downside protection. And our research suggested that investors would not only generate higher returns than owning the S&P 500 or some outside index of, you know, general index, but would also would experience less volatility. And when I first met Josh and Alan and the Gargoyle team, I quickly realized that this was the strategy that I had been looking for the last 25 years. Not only did Gargoyle invest using this underlying philosophy, this buy-right strategy of selling options to protect the portfolio, but they sort of improved upon this naive, you know, buy-right model that we were using 25 years ago. So let me just highlight a couple of sort of facets to that improvement, and I'm going to turn it over to Josh and Alan. So first, instead of investing in the underlying index, the S&P 500, for example, they have identified a quantitative approach to find cheap stocks, undervalued stocks, and in fact, that stock portfolio has outperformed the market in general by almost 5% a year in the 14 years they've been running this fund. That's a dramatic improvement over the underlying portfolio. You know, dramatic, you know, an unbelievable amount of alpha, in using our jargon. Secondly, instead of just selling index options against the portfolio in some static, using some static approach, like traditional buy-write models, they dynamically manage that option portfolio to maintain the hedge. And the results speak for themselves. If you look at the 14 years that the fund's been in existence, the fund is up cumulatively 240%, you know, nearly four times the S&P 500 or the long-short indices that we sort of compare ourselves to. And the fund, you know, came off a good year last year, a good year the year before. It was ranked in the top, 12th percentile last year in its category in Morningstar. And so the results have been very, very strong. And we'll talk to periods of outperformance and underperformance as we talk through, you know, the call. Finally, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that when we converted the fund from its former, you know, partnership structure, you know, its former hedge fund structure into a mutual fund, you know, the investors benefited from dramatically lower fees, daily liquidity, and virtually no minimums. And so it's a win-win-win for shareholders, and it's and we're very proud to be part of this joint venture. The performance results that you see on Morningstar, or that we publish, utilize an expense ratio based on the old fee structure, the higher fee structure, you know, and had we been running the fund using today's fee structure, obviously the historical results would be that much higher because the actual expenses are much less. So with that as my introduction, let me turn it over to Alan to give you an introduction to Gargoyle. I'll ask him to speak to his background and to sort of introduce the strategy to you, and then he'll turn it over to Josh, and then we'll open it up to David's questions. Alan, it's all yours.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. My name is Alan Salzbank, and Josh and I are the co-founders of Gargoyle Investment Advisor. Before we get started, I'd like to thank David and Morty for that introduction and for the opportunity to address you. And I also want to welcome everybody listening in to the call. Josh and I are going to do our best to introduce you to the River Park Gargoyle Hedge Value Fund, but you can also visit our website where you can get additional information about our strategy and our firm at gargoylegroup.com. At Gargoyle, we manage option positions designed to hedge over $600 million in equities for both individuals and institutions. All of our partners and the traders here began their option trading careers over 20 years ago and learned firsthand how to value options and manage risk by managing their own accounts. I began my career on Wall Street after graduating from the Wharton School in 1976. After I spent about 10 years in the brokerage business, Josh and I began working together more than 25 years ago as option market makers on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. In the mid-90s, we began to develop a way to conservatively invest some of the money we made on the floor using what we knew about stock options and stock markets in general. That account became the basis for the strategy that we still use today, and as part of that, we introduced our mutual fund through River Park in May of 2012. The strategy, as Morty pointed out, is really a combination of two separate strategies that are designed to increase returns and reduce volatility. I'll be going over the equity part of the strategy, and then Josh will cover the option component. And it's the option component which really sets us apart from all the other funds and managers out there. After that, we'll be happy to take any questions you might have. Let me first start by saying that the fund uses no leverage. The fund invests 100% of its available cash in between 80 and 100 stocks that we believe are undervalued and are likely to outperform the market. The process is pretty simple, but it requires discipline. First, we analyze the universe of the top 2,500 U.S.-listed stocks based on market capitalization. Each stock is then analyzed using four fundamental metrics: price to book value, price to earnings, price to free cash flow, and price to sales. These four metrics are compared to both the company's historical norms and the current value of its industry and sector peer groups. The goal is not to find low ratios on an absolute basis, but rather to discover companies that are undervalued in relation to their historical values and the current values of the companies in their peer group. Essentially, we now have 8 numbers to work with, 2 for each metric. We then analyzed the resulting numbers using an algorithm which assigns each company a J score. In loose terms, the J score is a measure of each company's discount or premium to what we think fair value is. Once these numbers are assigned, the selection process begins by narrowing the universe to the top 1,000 companies by market cap. From this group, we invest up to 2% of the fund's assets in the most undervalued stocks based on their J score. To make sure that the portfolio is well diversified, we subject the portfolio to constraints which limit exposure in each industry category. These limits are based on the S&P weightings plus up to 4%. This strategy fits well with our market-making background, as we're generally buying stocks that are out of favor. Essentially, we're buying them from people that are selling them and buying them on the bid. And as these stocks revert towards their mean fair value, they're liquidated and replaced with stocks that are then selling at greater discounts to the ones we're selling. The annual turnover of the portfolio tends to be low, and typically profits are achieved in the long-term tax status by the time that they hit our sell list. So to recap the stock side of the equation, we buy stocks that tend to have smaller market caps than those of the S&P, and they're relatively cheap based on our method of analyzing price to book, earnings, cash flow, and sales. We then diversify this portfolio broadly enough to reduce its risk, and then we hedge the portfolio using stock index options. Now Josh will take over and explain why we use index options to hedge and how we go about it.
Hello, everybody. This is Josh Parker. David, Morty, thank you very much. And for those of you on the call, I also appreciate your time being here. Just a brief background about me. Two things. I'm a securities and commodities lawyer by training. I cut my teeth defending the commodity exchange during the Hunt brothers' attempt to corner the silver market. So that ought to tell you about how old I am. And because harkening back to David's comment, both Alan and I have a head of distinguished gray hair. And the other thing about me is in my youth, I was a national caliber bridge player and I've represented the U.S. in international competition. And the reason that's relevant to this call is that the person that was responsible for bringing both Alan and myself down to the floor of the American Stock Exchange is a former world champion and Hall of Fame bridge player who was of the view that people that could excel at bridge should be able to excel at options trading. And when I was down there were over 100 bridge players on the floor, hopefully proving that point. So turning to the option side of the portfolio, as Al just discussed, the stock portfolio was always 100% long. And as Al mentioned to you, he and I are very conservative by nature. When we started the fund over 14 years ago, we wanted to hedge a portion of the market risk that's inherent in any stock portfolio. Given our background, it was natural for us to hedge through the use of options. And what we do is we sell index call options so that the options portfolio is approximately 50% short the market. This means that the fund is approximately 50% long the market at all times, 100% long in the stock portfolio, 50% short in the options portfolio. And a point I want to make that we are asked a number of times, we do not hedge the stock portfolio by shorting stocks. We do not hedge the stock portfolio by selling individual stock options. We hedge the stock portfolio by selling index call options. So how do we do that? Every day, we do a very careful analysis to determine the basket of major market indexes, S&P 500, Russell 2000, NASDAQ Composite, to determine the basket of major market indexes that best fits the current stock portfolio. We monitor the options portfolio every minute of every day to ensure that we have the right basket, and that the options portfolio is within an acceptable trading range around 50% short. Unlike most, perhaps all other option hedgers, we dynamically adjust the options portfolio real time to maintain the correct hedge. So let me take a step back and talk about options. There are two ways one can hedge a stock portfolio using options. You can either buy puts or you can sell calls. Buying puts is akin to buying an insurance policy. You pay your premium, you are guaranteed against any loss beyond your deductible, or in the case of buying puts, beyond the strike price of the put you purchase. But, and this is a big but, you have to pay the premium each and every month, and the amount you pay for those options act as a drag on the long-term performance of a stock and options portfolio. Let's take the other side. You can sell call options. Well, if buying puts are like being the insured, selling call options is akin to acting like the insurance company. We collect premium every month. Assuming that the insurance companies and the options are priced correctly, the total premium collected over time will exceed the claims paid out. Another way to look at this, and Morty mentioned it, is when you sell calls, you are selling the upside potential today and using those sales proceeds to cushion the fund in the case of a down market. And in the case of a market that is steadily going down, we are adjusting dynamically as the market goes down, which means that as the market goes down, we're buying back the call options that are far out of the money, that are trading for pennies, and we're selling closer to at the money call options, taking in more premium. So as the market goes down, we're building up more and more premium in the options portfolio. In either case, buying puts or selling calls, the options portfolio acts as a true hedge in that. And by that, I mean that when the stock portfolio goes down, the option portfolio invariably goes up, and vice versa. So, why do we choose to sell calls rather than to buy puts? We sell index call options because all index options are overpriced 88% of the time. And I want to repeat that. Index options are overpriced 88% of the time. There is no other instrument I know that is systemically overpriced to the extent that index options are overpriced, and they're overpriced by an average of about 35 basis points a month. And I know all of you are on the call saying, how is that possible in as liquid a market as we have, traded throughout the world, that these options are overpriced? And perhaps the word overpriced is a misnomer. And really what the marketplace is doing is they are pricing in a safety margin, a profit margin, a risk transfer premium, if you will, just the same way that insurance companies price in a risk transfer premium when they price their insurance policies. And because of that overpricedness, we sell index call options. We do not buy index puts. So what are the implications of selling index call options? First, this is not a tail risk strategy. We are the insurance company that collects the premium and pays off when a hurricane hits. In our case, the hurricane is a big rise in the stock market. In a case of a big rise in the stock market, our options portfolio will lose money. Fortunately for us, we are 100% long stock in that stock portfolio, and when the market is up big, our stock portfolio is going to be up. And 2013 is a perfect example. We lost 20% in the options portfolio. I'm not particularly proud of that, but our stock portfolio was up over 50%, and the net of those two were that even though we were 50% long throughout the year, we matched the S&P more or less, and we're up close to 30%. Now, this isn't a free lunch, and when the market is down significantly like it was in 08, S&P was down 37%, our stock portfolio was down 48%, but our options portfolio covered a third of the amount that our stock portfolio lost. Second implication of hedging against the down market is that we offer investors the ability to stay invested in a market during difficult times, which can't be underestimated for all of us who lived through 08. And because of our constant monitoring and our adjusting the options portfolio, We ensure that the fund is participating in all up moves, albeit on a reduced basis, and is hedged in all down moves, albeit only partially hedged. And a third and final implication is that our hedge is a long-term performance enhancer. The back and forth of capturing a portion of the upside, which will be in our history, has been more than the portion of the downside we capture in down markets. So capture more of the upside, capture less of the downside. The back and forth action means that over the long term, the options portfolio should make investors money. And that is what gives us our edge on the option side.
Cool.
I'm going to pass the baton back to David.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the explanation, guys. And I thought what I would try to do is to understand the big picture first and then maybe talk a little about the portfolio. Morningstar has you folks classified as a long-short fund. It's a box into which they put three or four disparate sorts of investments. And I was kind of wondering if you or Morty could help folks think through whether there are systemic or structural differences between what one would expect from a long-short fund, much like Mitch Rubin's, and your fund that are both kind of occupying the same space in the kind of reporting services mind. Is there something that you would that would be structurally different in performance or the risk profile?
Morty, do you want to take that, or you want me to?
Sure. Well, let me start, and I'm happy to have you add your thoughts afterwards. So, I mean, I think one of the big differences between, you know, the Gargoyle, you know, the hedge value fund, and a long-short fund like the one Mitch is managing or some of the others that are in the marketplace is, you know, is these are all hedge strategies, and therefore, you know, they're involved in the equity markets, they're exposure to the equity market, and therefore they belong in that quote-unquote long-short equity bucket. You know, the big differences that I, as I sort of look at it, are one, to what degree are they hedged? Is it market neutral, they're fully hedged, or is it long biased that they're hedged 40, 50, 60%? And the other sort of item that I look at when I look at these different funds is how is that exposure being determined? Is it an active decision on the part of the manager to say, boy, I think the market is cheap, and therefore I'm going to shift my exposure from 50% to 80% because I want more exposure to the market? Or, you know, conversely, I'm scared of the market, and I'm going to, you know, I don't see things that I want to own, and I think everything's expensive, and therefore I'm going to, you know, lower my exposure. I'm going to protect the portfolio. In contrast to something like, you know, this fund, which is basically, it's very mechanical. There's no, you know, we don't have an opinion as to what the market is going to do. It's very mechanical. Every month we rebalance at 50% net exposure. If the market starts moving up, okay, we are effectively becoming a net seller of the market. If the market moves down, we effectively become a net buyer. It's about contrarian in the way we sort of react, but it's all mechanical. It's all automatic. And it's what, I mean, Josh sort of alluded to this a few minutes ago when he said, you know, you're always in the market. So even, you know, in 2008, you know, as the market fell or first quarter of 2009, we didn't reduce our exposure to zero to protect ourselves. We still maintained exposure to the market. And frankly, that's what led to that 42% increase in 2009. We were able to rebound very quickly. I think one of the items that wasn't a takeaway to what Josh said, and I just want to sort of emphasize it, is every month, Gargoyle, regardless of what the market is doing, okay, every month they're selling between 1% and 2% option premium. So think of it on an annual basis. They're generating 15% to 20% or 24% even option premium a year. That's the cushion. That's the what lends the stability to the fund. If the market didn't do anything, and it just went up and down a little bit every year, right? You're starting off the year with a 20% income cushion. You know, it's a tremendous advantage as you think of sort of the structural advantage, you know, to the strategy itself. Josh, did you want to add something to that?
Just very quickly, I was thinking there were two differences, I would say, between us and the quote-unquote typical long-short fund. One is, I think a typical long-short fund is closer to market neutral, and Morty alluded to that. We target 50% long and try to maintain that throughout the course of the year. And the second thing is, I also think in a typical long-short fund, they're long stocks and short stocks, not in all cases, and I also think that's a differentiator for us. We are long stock, but on the short side, we're exclusively short index call options.
Right, and I think that was part of what I was trying to understand, Josh, is from the investor's perspective, how does being short index call options differ from being short stocks? I know that they're different things, but what would an investor in the fund experience something different than if you had a pure long short stock, long stock?
Yeah, no, a good question, and absolutely the experience would be different, and let me take an example, and I've tried to avoid numbers a little bit, but I think it's instructive here. If we sell the 1% out of the money call, and we collect 2% for it, let's say, if the market is up less than 1%, we're going to pocket that 2% that we collected on the selling the call option. If one were to have sold stock and the market were to have gone up, you would be losing on the short side of the stock. So it's possible in a lot of scenarios that you can actually make money on the stock portfolio because the market is up or our stock portfolio is up, and on the options portfolio because the market is not up enough to take away the entire premium we took in plus the amount by which the option is out of the money. I don't know if that was clear enough.
So, sure. Let me double check then. If you had a month in which the market simply drifted slowly upward, right, no dramatic move, you might well profit on both halves of your portfolio, where a long-short strategy would profit on one half of their portfolio and conceivably lose on the other half?
Right, exactly. In my example, if the market were to drift up 1%,
right,
our stock portfolio would, let's say, would have made that 1%, but our options will expire worthless, so the entire 2% premium that we collected at the beginning of the month by selling them goes into our
profit. Okay. In some ways, the best market for you is, you know, one of those the S&P makes 10% in a year sort of markets, if you want to measure it from the ability of the portfolio to generate kind of returns from both components. And so would my understanding be the worst market for the fund is going to be a sharply rising one, at least in kind of relative terms?
Yeah, I was going to say yes. There's sort of two answers. Is because we're long biased, a sharp market will hurt us, not as much as it would hurt a stock-only portfolio, but it would hurt us. But you're correct. On a relative basis, a market that swings wildly one direction and the other, never getting anywhere, could very well cause us to break even on the stock side and in a worst-case scenario, lose money in the options portfolio. But you're really talking, that's happened to us, I believe, 1 month in our 14-year period, August, I want to say, of 2008, when the market was swinging 4% a day.
Right. Yeah, violent swings are not the best scenario for option sellers, whether that be call options or put options or straddles. Any strategy that sells options does not do well in an environment where the market is moving around violently, even if it doesn't get anywhere.
Okay, great. So I was hopeful, and the folks on the discussion board raised particular questions about how your predecessor fund, the limited partnership version of this, kind of performed during the market meltdown. One of them noted that your maximum drawdown for that market was about 49% from late 07 to the market bottom in 09. I didn't know 49%. I didn't know if that was something that surprised you or something that you subsequently sort of adjusted strategy to, or if pretty much looking at the market you thought, yep, that was...
Yeah, that, that certainly was not a pleasant experience. It surprised us to the extent that in 2002, when there was a similar, you know, debacle in the market, not quite as bad, but when the dot-com bubble burst, you know, and the tech market fell apart, mm-hmm. we did very well. We actually broke even in that market with the market down 20%. Our takeaway in hindsight is 2020. The problem with our portfolio, as I mentioned in my discussion of the stock portfolio, is that we buy stocks that are typically out of favor. And they're typically mm-hmm. out of favor for a laundry list of different reasons throughout the portfolio. Some have management problems. Some have declining sales. Others haven't made money in years. So there's always something wrong to some extent with the names on our list in our portfolio. That's why we diversify. I don't know that I'd put all my money in any one name that we own in our portfolio. But as a diversified portfolio, we're buying stocks that are out of favor and we're buying them for less than they're worth. The problem in 2008 is that there was a perfect storm of all, pretty much all companies in the entire universe were having trouble raising money. There was a big credit freeze. There are stories of farmers that weren't able to get a loan to plant seed. That's how bad things were in 2008. And what happened was any potential reorganization possibilities in our portfolio, any potential takeovers, all of the premiums that these stocks would normally maintain, that was pulled out of the stock market. So any stock that might have had a 5% takeover premium in its price, that 5% or 10% was drained out of the portfolio. So our value portfolio, certainly we're not in stocks that were bulletproof in 2008, you know, like an Exxon or, you know, some of the large capital stock names, a Procter & Gamble and so forth. Those stocks mm-hmm. rarely hit our portfolio. So that metric of us being in value stocks hurt our stock portfolio. And fortunately, you know, as is always the case in a down market like that, our options were able to give back a large portion of that stock performance, but it was really the stock performance that was to blame in 2008 by virtue of the fact that it was a value portfolio.
Okay. By the way, the only thing I would add, this is Josh, the only thing I would add to what Alan said is really a little bit of the proof is in the tasting, and we didn't change our strategy going into 2009, and those very same stocks that everybody couldn't wait to get off their to get out of their portfolio in 2008 were the very stocks that everybody wanted to buy after March of 2009 when the Fed moved in, and those stocks that were down 48% in 08 were up 51 and change in 2009.
Okay. Great. I thought what I would do, guys, was okay with you. I'm going to ask one more question before we turn the call over to the folks who are listening in. And I was hoping that Denise might take a second and remind folks of how to do that.
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. If your question has been addressed and you would like to withdraw from the queue, you may press star, then two. Again, it is star, then one if you would like to ask a question.
Great. Thanks. And so if you folks want to queue up, we'll talk through one last topic and then turn it over to you. One of the things that I'm always curious about is how much money one could probably plausibly run in a strategy. You had mentioned that the Gargoyle Group runs about $600 million in equities that you're already hedging with options. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, that's right. Some of our institutional clients give us their equity portfolio to manage an option portfolio against. So we're just doing the options in those cases. And then there are a number of funds that we run where we manage the stock portfolio using our algorithms in addition to the option portfolio.
Okay. And so do you have an estimate then from the perspective of the River Park Fund of what the strategy capacity is, how big can the fund get before you need to think about restricting assets to maintain the strategy?
We estimate that using this strategy with the in the capitalization area of the top 1,000 U.S. listed companies, that we can probably run upwards of $2 billion using this strategy. Our median market cap is $7.3 billion, versus the S&P of $16.2 billion. So, you know, we're not, it's not a small cap fund. This is a fund that's medium, you know, mid-cap to large-cap stocks there. And we feel that there's tremendous capacity, and we know that the option markets can handle probably $20 billion in an overlay business.
Okay, great. Denise, are there questions from the folks?
At this time, I'm showing no questions in the queue, but it is star one if you would like to ask a question.
David, if it's okay, in the meantime, maybe I can ask a question.
I was thinking it was just a testament to how well Al and I explained what it is we do.
So, Josh, you basically you described why it is that we sell index call options instead of buying put options. You know, if options are expensive, we'd rather be a net seller. Okay, got it. One of the things that you didn't bring up, which I think is an interesting part of the strategy, is why do we sell index call options as opposed to individual calls on the stocks that we own? Like, why not selling calls on the stocks, and why did we decide instead to sell index call options?
Well, there's actually several answers to that. First is individual stock options, according to the academic studies, are by and large fairly priced. It'll differ from, you know, stock to stock, but in general, stock options are fairly priced, so you don't get the edge on the option side. Second, or maybe more important, so maybe this should have been first, is if you really believe the stocks in your portfolio are market outperformers, if you turn around and buy right those stocks individually, really what you're doing is you're cutting your profit short and letting your losses run. So if you really believe in your stock portfolio, as we do, which is outperforming the market by 500 basis points a year on average, why would we want to cap the profitability of the individual stocks that we believe so strongly in? There are some other ancillary reasons, but those are the two primary reasons.
Great, thank
you. Denise, yet anyone yet?
Yes, we do. If you'd like to take the first question.
We would be delighted by that option.
Sure. The first question will come from Ben Jones. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Ben, you have to unmute, or someone has to unmute you.
I heard a hello.
I don't know. Denise, did you break, Ben?
No. Mr. Jones, your line is open. All right. We'll move on to the next question. Mr. Jones can queue up again. The next question will come from Judy Trichin. Please go ahead.
Hi. You've told us about your past and present. Based on your experience, obviously we don't really know what's going to occur. What does your crystal ball tell you?
About the direction of the stock?
Brewing. Yes.
I can give you the glib answer. When J.P. Morgan, not the company, but the individual, was asked that question, he said fluctuate was his answer. You know, look, there are many people that devote their lifetime to predicting the market, and obviously the biggest question mark right now is what's the Fed going to do? Is it going to continue with the tapering policy? And one of the things that we've seen, all of us seen over the last 4 years, is there was a Bernanke put on the market. So it was very hard for the market to go down knowing that the Fed was going to move in and make sure the market didn't drop. So the only thing I know, and I'm going to put "I know" in quotes, is we don't have that Bernanke put, so the market's going to return to, I would think, more its long-term nature, which is compounding out at under 10% over the long term. But that may be a little bit of a cop-out answer. We really don't specialize in in predicting the future of the market, which is one of the reasons that we maintain a 50% hedge at all times, is because we're uncomfortable predicting the future of the market.
I would add to that that, you know, one of the things that recently occurred to me is that we all lived through the crash of 87, and were down on the floor at the time. And the one thing that I noticed is I looked at a long-term chart of the market. And if you look at a long-term chart of the market going back to 1950, for argument's sake, you can't even find where the 1987 crash occurred. It's such a small blip on the radar screen that it's sort of irrelevant. If I could go back in time and invest every penny I had and mortgage my house in the market on October 16th of 1987, knowing that the following day the market was going to drop 22%, it was still the right move to make, because now the market's up tenfold from there. And we believe that, you know, the long-term market is the place to be. Whether the timing for that over the next 6 months is right or not is not something we get involved in. We want to be invested at all times. Our mandate is to be long in this strategy, and that's the path that we follow.
One of the things that we should mention, though, you know, and this is not related to having a crystal ball about the market, but it's related more to our strategy, is that over the last year or two, you know, the strategy has had a major, major headwind in front of it. And that headwind was that implied volatilities in the marketplace were very, very low. Maybe that was this put, the Bernanke put, that was causing that. But basically, there was no fear in the market. And therefore, when we were selling options, while we believed they were expensive, okay, they were still relatively cheap to history. Okay, they were more expensive than the actual volatility, but they were still low. And what I mean by that is we probably averaged close to 1% premium a month that we were selling instead of 2%. Now that implied volatilities have spiked up a little bit over the last couple of weeks, we're actually getting more premium for our sale of options, and that headwind that we were facing has actually, you know, more or less disappeared over the last, you know, 3-4 weeks.
Yeah, just to add a little bit of detail to what Morty just said, over history, and Morty keeps talking about this 2%, over the last 20-some-odd years, on average, we collect 2% a month for the 1% out-of-the-money S&P call option. But the average is a little bit misleading. It's been as low as around 1% or a little less during the Goldilocks years of 2005-2006. But in the fourth quarter of 2008, we were collecting almost 8% for the 1 month, 1% out of the money call. And that's so Morty's absolutely right. We've had the options portfolio had a bit of a headwind over the last couple of years because we weren't collecting as much in premium. The last month or so, we've returned closer to historic averages, and we know that there'll be a time in the future where we'll be collecting 5, 6, 7% because there'll be a fear back in the market.
Great, thank you. Denise, other folks?
Yes, our next question will come from Edward Stadzinski. Please go ahead.
I guess I'm one of your followers. You didn't know you had a cult, David.
Ah, yes.
Would it be fair to describe your long strategy as a regression to the mean approach?
In a number of ways, it is. You know, one of the advantages, you know, Josh mentioned a little bit earlier that when we sell options when the market's declining, we're selling options at higher volatilities on a relative basis because there's more fear in the market. And generally, that fear abates. The market begins to rally back, and we're buying back options at relatively low prices in that case. But that's one aspect. The other aspect is the stock portfolio, where, as I mentioned, we're buying stocks that are out of favor, and, you know, frankly, they're stocks that are perhaps no better or worse than the typical stock, but they're selling at prices that are below what they should be, and those things will generally smooth themselves out over time as management changes, as there's reorganizations within the company, or as things just get better, as they tend to do, you know, when things are going poorly. and things get worse eventually in times when things are going well.
I think if you look at the long-term studies, you'll see that stock prices fluctuate around the quote-unquote fair market value of the stock. And that's so I think, yes, to your question, we do trade a little bit of the mean reversion. We buy stocks that are out of favor, knowing that they're eventually going to come back into favor. And it's happened time and time again. People just don't want to own particular stocks because they don't believe in the industry or they don't believe in the stock or it has some headline risk. And sure enough, once that all calms down, that stock moves up. And the flip side is also true. You get stocks that everybody absolutely positively has to own until there's a hiccup, and then everybody can't wait to get rid of them, and they go from one extreme of being overbought or overpriced to the extreme of being cheap.
And how should the average investor think about the difference in shorting strategies or the differences in long-short funds? Because when I hear the term short, and I'm dating myself this way, but I think back to the equity analysts I knew 15-plus years ago who would tell me about sitting there in the morning and following a particular equity stock that they had a buy on, and the phone would ring, and you would think you had Darth Vader on the other side of the phone because you would proceed to have someone telling you everything that was wrong with the company, what thieves the managements were, and in such detail that you kind of came away shaken about your investment thesis. And when I look at the funds that are out there, including yours, nobody seems to be doing that now as a shorting strategy.
I wouldn't say, I don't know. I mean, maybe Morty and David know better than I about people who short stock on the other side. You know, my concern is with the short sellers that we've talked to, most of them look for the stocks that they think are going out of business. There's fraud that people haven't uncovered, and I don't mean to paint with a broad brush on this, but the concern is that John Maynard Keynes said, you know, can you stay solvent longer than the market can stay irrational? And you see some of these people, Jim Chanos and David Rocker, they need to sit with these positions. And the problem with a short position is as the market is telling you you're wrong, at least temporarily, the mistake becomes a bigger and bigger percentage of your position. When we buy a stock and a 1% position in a stock and we're wrong, it naturally becomes a 3/4 or 0.5% of our position. The reverse is true of a short stock position. There are people that are very talented at it, but
they got large headwinds. They're fighting a market that generally goes up. They've got the potential for short squeezes and that type of thing. And you know, those that can find alpha in the short side of their portfolio, you know, those are the real gems out there. We have it by design by selling index options, which are, you know, as Josh mentioned earlier, you know, 80-85% of the time are overvalued. So we have built-in alpha in our short positions. The long short seller, the short sellers out there that run a short long short fund have to find alpha on both sides of their stock selection, on the long side and on the short side. And it can be done, but it's not easy.
Let me offer two quick thoughts there. I've been buying stocks and shorting stocks for a long time. The first thought is when we short stocks, at least in our fund, you know, we're not trading off information, and what we're doing is we're trying to find companies that we think are just fundamentally flawed. We think that these are businesses that are facing major headwinds in the future. Peak earnings are behind them. They're losing share. There's a major trend that's taking place. It's, you know, if you had your choice, you'd rather be long, you know, the mobile communication and short PC companies at this point. It's just a trend that's going to continue for years and years. That's the first thought. Second thought is that the phenomenon that you described, those bear raids, you know, existed 15, 20, 25 years ago, and frankly, they were illegal then, and frankly, the regulatory environment is just much stronger now. You really can't go around and, you know, and I didn't know people that did it, but I've heard about it just like you did. But, I mean, you can't go around making up stories about companies and trying to manipulate the market. It's illegal, And maybe the regulatory market is much stronger now. People aren't doing it as much now because they're afraid of getting caught.
But to your first example, hasn't the information flow with all of the people out trying to do this now tightened the window up for you to be able to execute well the kind of strategy you're talking about?
Yeah, I think to a large extent that's true. And I think that, you know, the approach that we take is, you know, we do this on the short side as stock pickers. We try to take a very long-term view. So we're not trading off of, you know, quarterly, you know, some projection of, you know, is the company going to beat or miss earnings next quarter, but rather, you know, what do we really believe about that company's ability to double their sales over the next 3 or 4 years? I mean, do we think that the business is going to grow or not grow? And that's, you know, that's research, that's insight, that's analysis, that's not, you know, information. That's basically, you know, do your homework. And, you know, in a 3% growth economy, you know, there are going to be companies that are going to double, they're going to grow 10, 15, 30%, and there are going to be other companies that are going to shrink. I mean, that's how you're going to average 3% growth. And so, yeah, it's, you know, on the short side, it's hard to find those companies that, frankly, are going to decline 15, 20% a year, and there are plenty of them.
And just for the sake of folks who are listening in, the last part of the conversation here applies more to river short, long short opportunity rather than to the gargoyle fund. They are the two sides of the kind of hedging approach for funds generally. Denise, are there other folks?
There are. The next question will come from the location of Ben Jones. Please go ahead.
Oh, I'm back.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I apologize. Sorry about that earlier. I had my phone on mute. I guess the big elephant in the room in the investment industry is just the proliferation of exchange-traded funds. And, you know, nowadays I think there are about 4 or 5 kind of buy-right covered call-based ETFs. I think the biggest competitor to this fund will be the PBP. I guess from your experience, what separates your mutual fund from some of these new buy-right ETFs that are coming out?
I would say a couple of things. A number of the ETFs that are coming out are replicating the CBOE S&P 500 buy-right called the BXM. And so two things. One is we don't buy an index. We buy a basket of stocks that we believe are going to outperform the market, and we have done so for the last 14 years. So there's alpha generated on that side that you don't see in a lot of the ETFs. And the second thing is the option side of the equation. I'm going to say all of those ETFs, but I may be wrong, but my belief is that all of those ETFs use a static approach. So on one day a month, they will sell whatever call options is part of their strategy, and they will do nothing until the next expiration Friday of those options. And what that means is that over the course of the month, from the day they sell until the next expiration, they are at the mercy of the market. And if the market goes up, they're going to have no market exposure. They're going to be 100% long in their stock side and 100% short in their option side. Or the reverse is going to happen. The market's going to go down, so they're going to be 100% short on, I'm sorry, 100% long on the stock side as the market's going down. And the options are so far out of money, they're giving them no coverage. So that's one of that I would say on the option side is the key difference between us and those ETFs. We make sure that as the market goes up, we are going to participate, albeit on a reduced basis. And as the market goes down, we are going to be hedged at all times. So we don't run the problem of the static strategies being 100% long or no market exposure whatsoever at exactly the wrong times.
Yeah, Alan, I don't know whether you have those statistics in front of you or whether you remember them or not, but we were in a meeting a couple of weeks ago where you shared with me the statistics of if you just had the S&P 500 with our dynamic option and compared it to the BXM or the static, you know, ETF model, you know, the improvement both in performance and the reduction in volatility. Do you have those numbers there by any chance?
Yes, I do. So in other words, if we took out the alpha that we generate from our stock portfolio, going back to 2000, actually these numbers are through 2012, but for the 13-year period, 2000 through 2012, the BXM was up 52%, which was better than the S&P. The S&P over that time period was just up under just 24%. But the actively managed portfolio, which maintains a hedge at all times, that was up 110% cumulatively over that period. And the entire advantage to the dynamically hedged approach came from periods where the market fluctuated enough so that the, you know, as Josh was mentioning, so that you're going to be either long more than 65% or long less than 35%. Those periods where the market moved enough so that the strategy wasn't working anymore cost a tremendous amount to the static approach.
Thank you.
Great.
Our next question will come from the location of Stephen Jasper. Please go ahead.
Are you there, Steve? Oh, there you are. There you briefly were.
Mr. Jasper, your line is open.
Are you muted?
We'll move on to Paul Bellows. Please go ahead.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. I have the Morningstar 10-year numbers for you guys. And for 2004 through 2010, you had 1 year where you didn't beat the S&P, which is obviously a terrific record. In 2011, 12, and 13, you were a bit below the S&P. Anything you draw from that observation?
I'll hop in, so I'll let Alan think about 2011. I can't remember back that far. You know, 2012 and 2013 were very strong markets across the board. And going back to the discussion of the options portfolio, we are going to be a drag on those years. We won't be, even though we target ourselves to be 50% long, we weren't a 50% drag in either of 2012 or 2013 because our stock portfolio did significantly better than the market. But in strong years, like the last 2 years, we in general are going to underperform. But hopefully we will make that back in the years where the market moves, particularly in the years where market moves sideways, where we can profit both from the stock portfolio and the options portfolio.
If you look at those last 2 years, though, I mean, while we underperformed, you know, not by a lot against the S&P, you know, we dramatically outperformed long-short indices and other long-short funds because, you know, they were hedged and didn't do as well as we did.
And I'll also just chime in with a comment about 2011. 2011, if you recall, was a little bit of an aftershock of 2008. I recall being away at a time when the U.S., you know, their credit rating was cut during the summer. We had tremendous credit issues. We had European issues. You know, and there were a lot of things going on in the market that caused tremendous volatility and volatile swings, you know, within short periods of time. And as I mentioned earlier, that's not the best scenario for our strategy. Again, our strategy is one that, you know, takes us through long-term cycles and increases return over those long-term cycles as we go through up and down markets. But the violent moves within short periods of time tend to, you know, put us a little bit behind the eight ball for a period of time.
Thank you.
By the way, having said that, the options portfolio did make money in 2011.
Right. The stock portfolio in 2011, our stock portfolio was just down over 5.5%. If I recall, I think the market was unchanged that year. So our stocks that year underperformed by close to 6%, whereas the option portfolio got back half of that loss or more than half of that loss, but still putting us into negative territory for the year, where we lost just under 4%, I guess, in 2011 versus the unchanged market.
Great. Denise, we're kind of toward the top of the hour. Do we have many folks waiting, or?
We have two additional people in the queue.
Morty, do you want to try two last questions?
Sure, we'll do two last questions.
Okay. The next question will come from Ken Norman. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the call. What would you say a prudent investor, what percent of his portfolio would he allocate to your strategy?
Well, my first answer is 100%.
Right.
No, and Alan may have a different answer on this. We're not asset allocators, so my answer would be to someone who makes the asset allocation decisions, it would be whatever you want to whatever you think your client or you should have allocated to large cap or large cap value, that we think you should give 100% to us, because that's the bucket we fill. Or subject to whatever diversification rules you have, we're comfortable filling in that bucket of your large cap value.
I'll just add to that Josh and I both have a significant amount of our assets, in this strategy. This is really our stock allocation. We believe that this is a better way to invest in the market over the long term, and we're strong believers in that.
Right.
Thank you.
100% of my U.S. domestic equity exposure is in this strategy.
Thank you.
Great. Denise, one last question.
And the final question will come from the location of Stephen Jasper. Please go ahead.
Well, this time I'm not on mute. Hi, guys. Thank you very much. I was wondering what you thought. You were talking about out-of-favor stocks. Do any of the gold miners meet your criteria, some of the larger ones perhaps?
Surprisingly not. I keep looking for them in our screening, and every now and then I check to make sure they're actually in there, because I see just the way these things have gotten beaten up, and from my personal perspective, I believe that they're definitely in the category of stocks that are out of favor that should be bought, but they haven't hit our screening process yet. We do have and have had a number of the metal stocks. We've had Alcoa, AK Steel. I believe we had U.S. Steel. I'm not sure if we still have it in the portfolio, to be honest with you. But we are in that space to some degree, but not in the gold stocks themselves.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, guys. And thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
We've kind of reached the top of the hour, and so I would like to take this opportunity to do a couple things. I would like to thank Josh and Alan, Morty, and all of you for your time tonight. And I'd like to let you know that a recording of this call and an audio profile of the fund will be available at The Observer March 1st. Highlights of this call and a link to an MP3 of it will be posted on The Observer's discussion board, to which you are all certainly invited, within the next 48 hours. As soon as we have a copy of that link from the good folks at Chorus Call, we'll make it available to you. And so thank you all for joining us tonight. I wish you well in the days and months ahead. Take care now. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference has now concluded. We thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect your lines.